Hello, everyone. Welcome along to episode 7 of the Director's Box podcast. If you've been with us for the first 6, you'll know that I'm Kev, and alongside me, I've got Craig Gill, as always. Craig, how are you doing?
Very well, Kevin. Thank you. And you?
Yeah, not too bad at all. Quiet week with no sort of Luton football to go and watch, and England didn't exactly inspire me either, which we'll come on to shortly. How about yourself?
Yeah, obviously we've had coaching out here, and obviously been glued watching the Wales games, obviously.
And we'll come on to those shortly, because coming up on this episode of the podcast, we will look back at Wales's unfortunately failed attempts to make it through to Euro 2024. I'll discuss with Craig maybe the future of Rob Page. It's been announced today that he is going to be staying on beyond these qualifiers. We'll also, as I've got a coach alongside me, find out if we can prepare for penalties and penalty shootouts or not, if it really is just the lottery that people say that it is. We'll then move on to have a look at England. Their preparations ahead of Euro 2024 didn't exactly inspire over the weekend either. Neither did Scotland, so we'll look at where they're at as well. We'll bring up this week's poll during that time. And then we'll bring it back to domestic football, which returns this weekend. There's a huge, huge game in the Premier League title race, which we will have a look at. And then, of course, 2 sets of matches in the EFL over the Easter weekend. And we'll take a look at all 3 divisions and pick out some matches that might impact both ends of the table there. Let's start this episode off, though, with the big sort of football of the week, Craig, which was the Wales qualification campaign. I think we all kind of expected them to beat Finland, maybe not as convincingly as they did beat Finland, but the qualification was always going to be down to their home game against Poland. Unfortunately, it was one of those nervy nights, wasn't it? And the ball just wouldn't go in the back of the net. And once it went to penalties, it really was all up in the air.
Yeah, the Finland game, first of all, obviously that was a great win. Good performance, actually, and a good win, 4-1. 2 early goals in each half, which obviously always settles the nerves, if you like. But Wales set out like a house on fire, really. They high intensity, high press, obviously buoyed by a fantastic home crowd, the Red Wall, and everyone in full voice there. And as I say, scored quite early on with the opening goal. And really controlled the game for large periods and didn't allow Finland to settle. Went in the lead, obviously, at half-time, 2-1 up. Finland having got one back just before the half. But then scored another early one, again in the second half. Brennan Johnson at far post. And then obviously got a fourth into the second half, which obviously set up the Poland game, which, as you said, was a totally different kettle of fish. I think we mentioned it in the last episode that we guessed that the Poland game would be a far tighter affair given the qualities that Poland possess. And so it turned out to be, really. Poland, obviously led by Lewandowski, very tight unit, difficult to break down. Although Wales did get a lot of success, actually, especially down that left-hand side through Nico Williams and Brennan Johnson. And I'm just surprised and disappointed that they didn't use that tactic more often than they did, to be honest, because they undid that right side of the Polish defence on numerous occasions, but unfortunately didn't create anything really clear cut. Went into the lead, so we thought, just before half time, from a set piece, and we mentioned set pieces previously, corners in particular, when the ball was headed back by Kiefer Moore. Ben Davis thought he'd scored and taken us into the interval with a 1-0 lead. But unfortunately, that was ruled out for offside, which I think the replay showed. So that was disappointing. And in the second half, Poland seemed to change their tactics and seemed to play more in possession and more on the front foot, more positively then, if you like. Wales defended well. I thought Joe Roden particularly did exceptionally well at the heart of the Welsh defence. And Ben Davis as well. He was colossal for Wales, certainly led by example as the captain. In the absence of Aaron Ramsey, he's come on leaps and bounds since his move to Spurs all those years ago, and he does it week in, week out for Spurs, and certainly led by example for Wales against Poland.
Yeah, he was the standout performer, wasn't he? Over the course of the night, not just with the football, but also the leadership. I mean, we saw that in unfortunately trickier circumstances at the end of the game, but I thought extra time was the area where I was kind of disappointed with Wales, Craig, because they seem to lose a little bit of shape and they seem to lose a little bit of sort of patience, really. There was all to sort of panic. When the ball came into the box, it was just head it out again and get it as far away from goal. Whereas one or two times, like you mentioned in that first half, with no Matty Cash down the right-hand side for Poland, Poland did look like they were there for the taking down that side. But it was just get it away from our goal. And I mean, Kiefer Moore wasn't really able to hold the ball up in that and get others into play. And it just seemed like Wales kept on inviting pressure on in that extra time period, albeit Poland never really created anything themselves.
Yes, obviously extra time was an interesting affair, wasn't it? But I just want to quickly recap on the first half, really. And first of all, Wales's lineup going into the game, they replaced Brooks with Kiefer Moore, so they went with a target player as opposed to someone who's a little bit more mobile and agile and quick. So the intention there obviously was to, you know, trying to get him to occupy at least one of the two centre backs, obviously. But I just felt at times he sort of dropped too deep into midfield, and as a consequence sort of negated the space that Wales had enjoyed against Finland. And as a consequence of that, I thought we struggled to get the ball forward and get the ball in behind the back four, particularly in wide areas, you know, where we've got great pace, you know, Harry Wilson particularly. And as I've already mentioned, you know, Williams and Johnson down that left-hand side. So I just thought we lacked that fluidity in attack. And I just, you know, I thought we were almost our own worst enemies, really, in sort of, you know, negating that midfield space, as I said. But then second half, we mentioned, you know, Poland, different kettle of fish, came up with a far more positive attitude, which we defended. And then, as you said, into extra time then, it was almost a case of both teams not wanting to lose the game rather than not wanting to win it, almost. And you just felt as if, you know, we brought Brooks on, and Dan James as well, of course. Brooks came on, but then unfortunately was substituted back off again. But we know now that obviously that was because he hadn't trained for 2 days, and whether that was through injury or fatigue, we're not sure. But I just felt as if we could really have capitalised more on the pace in the team, and sadly we didn't. And then of course it went to penalties, and we know the outcome of that. Poland scoring all five of theirs, and Dan James missing the last penalty for Wales. For Poland to win it 5-4.
At no stage did Dan James convince me that he A, wanted to take that penalty, and B, that he was going to score that penalty. He was like lobbing the ball up in the air to himself as he was walking to it, kind of. He had a picture of nerves on his face, and then when he put the ball down, he couldn't decide which way he was going to run up to it, how he was going to run up to it. And the one thing you can't really do when you take a penalty these days with all the analytics and everything that's around is telegraph which way you're going to go. And that's exactly what he did. And world-class goalkeepers like Chesney are generally going to save those. Thought Danny Ward had a chance at saving the second Polish penalty. Seemed to dive past it. Obviously, hearts and mouths were with all Welsh fans when Kiefer Moore's penalty started pinballing off the crossbar, but thankfully that one went in. That could easily have come out and been quite nasty. But to be fair, the penalties apart from the last one were really, really good. Goalkeeper didn't really get much of a chance of any of them, as I say, apart from that second Polish one that Ward had. But when it comes to penalties, I mean, as an Englishman, I know all too well the downfalls of penalty shootouts, but there's this kind of belief or myth, we'll clarify that now, actually, whether penalty shootouts are a lottery. Are they a lottery, or as a coach, can you actually do anything to prepare for them?
I don't think they are a lottery, no. I think you can prepare for them. And you know, it basically comes down to 1v1, keeper against the taker. Technique and mindset, isn't it, really? You know, and you can certainly practice technique. Mindset is also trainable, obviously. And that's why now, you know, teams have sports performance psychologists, certainly the top level, and I know the international teams do as well. But I think you can train for them, certainly. Going back to Dan James's penalty, not to hark on about it too much, but it's a long walk, you know. I've been involved in penalty shots as a player many, many years ago, but it's a long walk, actually, from the halfway line up to the penalty box, you know. So I encourage my players to jog that. just to cover the ground quickly and get to the ball as quick as you can. Whilst you're waiting for the penalty shootout, just sort of focus on make your mind up where you're gonna play it. Stick to that decision. Get the ball, place it on the spot, make sure it's adequately placed, obviously, and not in any rut or whatever. Make sure the referee's happy with it. You don't have to go back up and walk and do that again. And then set yourself up. Deep breaths. If you look at Lewandowski, that's exactly what he did. A couple of deep breaths, focus, compose yourself, pick your spot, and then go for that and don't change your mind. I think with Dan James, I think if you look at the way he set himself up after he placed the ball, he walked back and he approached the ball very much straight on, which is great if you then decide to open your hips and open your foot and maybe go the opposite way. But the way he ran at the ball and the way his hips were facing, you know, it was very much pretty evident with his body shape which side he was going to go. Unfortunately, he didn't find a corner, whether that be bottom corner or high enough to escape the goalkeeper's hand. And in the end, it was a fairly comfortable save for Chesney, wasn't it, really? So disappointed in that. And I don't think he's a regular goal scorer anyway. But going back to your point about, you know, with performance analysts and you know, them checking in on previous penalties, of course, they can do that with regular penalty takers. But of course, if you have, you know, penalty takers, especially in a shootout, who don't take penalties regularly for their club side, then it does become a bit of a lottery, really. You know, and then it can be down to the goalkeeper and whether or not they just gamble and go one way, or whether they look at the body shape and the angle of the hips and foot just before contact, and then decide to go one way. Good friend of mine, actually, good friend from school, Mike Jones. He was a goalkeeper for many years, and he's got an interesting take on it. He said, "Well, if you look at the penalties that were taken, if you stood still, you know, or feigned to go one way and then just retained your position centrally, probably would have saved four of those penalties." So that's another school of thought, of course.
I've said this. I said this to a Luton goalkeeper 2 or 3 years ago. We were absolutely disastrous at penalty shootouts. So much so that I just said to him, why don't you just faint and stand still? Because some one of the five will smack it down the middle because they're so nervous. Since then, he hadn't faced another penalty in a shootout. But I really do believe there's something in that. I also believe, like you just said, that you can prepare for penalties. I mean, the biggest penalty shootout that sort of any of my teams have been involved in was the playoff final shootout at the end of last season. And obviously it helped that we knew that we were going into the playoffs, sort of playoff final, sort of 10 days ahead of it. Whereas obviously Wales only had 4 days to prepare for this one, but the semi-final could have had penalties anyway. So they'll have known that they needed to prepare. But what Rob Edwards did, which was really noticeable, I knew this before it, but it was really evident on the day, is every time Coventry took a penalty in that shootout, they scored all of their first six, Coventry. But rather than let the Coventry keeper start time wasting and everything else, our goalkeeper would go and get the ball out of the net, and he would break up that walk that you just mentioned, and he would take the ball towards the oncoming Luton player and probably meet him around about the edge of the D on the penalty box, obviously give him a word of encouragement or something, or calming word or whatever it was. But this happened on every single one, and Luton scored in every single penalty, and it's something I've not seen before. And I knew that it was something to it. And he tried, our goalkeeper, tried to do the exact opposite and get to the ball ahead of the Coventry one. And the only one he managed to do it for was the one that they missed. So just that split second delay of breaking it up or everything else that made him sort of just deviate from his path. All our goalkeeper did was roll it towards the referee. He didn't do anything or anything else, just gave the ball to the referee, and the player had to go to the referee and get it. Just got in his head and broke it up. And he missed the target completely with the penalty. The other 13 penalties, all brilliant penalties. But just something as simple as that makes me think that, yes, you can actually practice these things and you can get in the opposition's head. And they're not a lottery. They're only a lottery if you treat them as a lottery.
Yes, really interesting, isn't it? All the psychological games, you know. I remember Bruce Grobbelaar in the European Cup final, as it was then, before the Champions League. I'm not sure if it was in Rome, I think. Doing the jelly legs, you know, just to take the taker's mind off and break his concentration, really. I just tell my players, you know, even in training, you know, get good at hitting one particular penalty really, really well, you know, with precision, obviously. But if you can put precision with power, then obviously that's even better. But I've known on the national stage, I think, before either major tournaments or going to play in, you know, in playoff games, for example, whereby coaches have had big speakers put out, you know, in the 18-yard box, either side of the of a goal, and blasted out sort of the opposition chants, you know, just to try and recreate a bit of atmosphere. I think that's almost impossible to do because the nature, you know, you might put yourself in any player's shoes who had to take that penalty in that shootout at the weekend, whereby, you know, you've got the home crowd, you've then got the away crowd, obviously, you know, voicing their opinions and as vociferous as it was, would have been from both parties. Then you've got to concentrate on the penalty, and then of course then, you know, you're then in the lap of the gods with regards to the goalkeeper's performance on whether or not the goalkeeper can get across and save it. So it really is a technical piece. It's very much a mindset. But for me, it's, as my old dad used to say, low and hard. You know, put me in the corners, and no matter how tall you are, you're struggling to get there anyway. But yeah, so disappointing Wales, way for Wales to lose and not qualify for the Euros, obviously. You know, and I think with that young squad, they can go on and really be a force and hopefully qualify for World Cup 2026, which will be here in America, Mexico and Canada.
Yeah, indeed. It's been announced today that Rob Page is being kept on, presumably to lead that World Cup qualifying. That actually comes after the Nations League, which is all that they've confirmed that he's in charge for at the moment. Is he the right man to take Wales forward?
I think so, to a degree, yes. You know, he's gone through a huge transitional period, hasn't he? You know, with the loss of Gareth Bale, Joe Allen, Joe Ledley, Chris Gunter, you know, some real stalwarts there in the Welsh squad, which obviously got them to Euro 2016 and then to the World Cup. But, you know, he's had to, you know, bring in a lot of youngsters. And I know from the Welsh pathway, a pathway which is led superbly well by a friend of mine, Richard Williams, from 17s with Craig Knight and Dane Facey, right the way through the age groups, so the 21s with Matty Jones, and then obviously through the senior squad. So there's a clear pathway there, and Wales have done magnificently well in bringing young players through that pathway. And I think now, you know, hopefully leading into this next World Cup campaign, they'll start to see the fruits of that labour, you know?
Yeah, I think continuity is key, isn't it? England have showed that. And, you know, generally at international level, the nations that stick with their manager long enough to build the pathway that you mentioned are the ones that are generally, by and large, the more successful ones. So I fully understand why Rob Page has been given the job for, well, at least the Nations League, and presumably it'll be the World Cup qualifying that comes so quickly off the back of the Nations League that it wouldn't make much sense to only give him a contract for that and then say thanks but no thanks, unless, of course, someone truly world-class comes along in the meantime. So that's why it was unfortunate for Wales, heartbreak for Wales, really. They probably were the better side over the course of the 120 minutes, but ultimately one spot kick undid them. But congratulations to Poland, who go to the Euros. Congratulations also to Georgia, who've qualified for their first major tournament, having beaten Greece also on penalties on Tuesday evening. And also to the Ukraine, who came from behind in both of their matches, actually, against Bosnia-Herzegovina and Iceland. And they will be at the Euros. And after everything that country's gone through, I don't think anyone will begrudge them a spot in Germany in the summer. Let's bring the attention on to England, Craig, and I'll lead most of the way here because obviously they clashed with the Wales game, which you were far more interested in, quite rightly so. We've got a poll on Director's Box at the moment regarding Gareth Southgate and whether he's the right man for England. Your options are yes, no, decide after the Euros, or not sure, and there's a little over a week left to vote on that one. So get your votes in and let us know your opinions with Gareth Southgate. He's starting to devise opinions with England fans, I think, Craig, because there's a golden generation of England attacking to be intent on having the handbrake on throughout. I have to say, I'm not really one of these Gareth Southgate haters. Don't get me wrong, I think we can do a lot better than Gareth Southgate. But at the same time, I think we can do a lot worse as well. And I think every Englishman has to appreciate that he's taken them to a World Cup semi-final, a Euro Championship final, and a World Cup quarter-final. And that's rich days, regardless of the talent that he has at his disposal. But he's starting to send out some messages to me, and I never like it when mixed messages come along. So at the start of this international break, he mentioned that he wanted to look at the future, which kind of put a few sort of doubts in my mind, because we're 3 months away from the Euros. We should be looking at the Euros, not the future by now. So he said he wants to have a look at the future in two games against Brazil and Belgium, two difficult games in their own right, but then still picks Jordan Henderson in his squad. And then he picks Jarrad Branthwaite, which I'm a huge fan of. I've seen him against Luton two or three times already, and he looks like a Rolls Royce of a defender. He's got pace. He can defend. He can attack in the opposition box. He's probably the heir in sort of to Harry Maguire in that left centre-back position. But at no stage over the two games did he play him. And I'm kind of... You started off the international break wanting to look at the future. You've got the best English young defender. You've had injuries because Harry Maguire missed the Belgium game because he was injured. And he chose 32-year-old Lewis Dunk to start the Belgium game. I mean, we all know what Lewis Dunk is by now. He's been around long enough. So I didn't like that mixed message from the start, really. And I'm not a great fan of his selections in midfield either. Kobbie Mainoo did really, really well. I've absolutely no problem with that. But Jordan Henderson, he's yesterday's man for me. And I think he admitted that when he went to the Saudi league. Okay, I know he's back at Ajax now. But I can understand why people are getting a bit annoyed with Southgate. If you're going to look to the future, look to the future. Or if you're going to focus on results in these two friendlies, focus on results in these two friendlies. But don't do both and don't mix messages. And all of a sudden, I just wonder if England are going to go to the Euros not underprepared, because they had a lot of injuries in this international break, but just with maybe more questions than they'd like that need answering.
Yeah, I can understand your viewpoint, Kevin. Obviously, I think it's a tough one as well, isn't it, for the coach? Because obviously you've got these two games, two friendly internationals, if you want to call them that, where you know there's no competition at stake. Put it that way. So it's an opportunity to see some of your squad players, bring them in. So obviously, if Lewis Dunk's going to be involved in the championships in the summer, I get that. I mean, he's had a fantastic couple of seasons down at Brighton. Yes, he might be 32, but he does a great job for Brighton, with and without the ball. So you can see that the justification for that, and absolutely, understand that, you know, Gareth Southgate's thinking on that one. As for bringing Braithwaite into the squad, maybe he wanted to introduce him to the environment, you know, the training environment and the squad, and just being in and around the squad, perhaps. But like you, I thought he might have, might have started one of the games, certainly the second game, perhaps. But it's a difficult one because, you know, he probably does want to look at younger players and look to the future. But, you know, I've never been in that situation. But if I'm leading towards a tournament, I'm probably looking at putting things in place in preparation for that tournament rather than looking, for who I'm going to include in my World Cup squad after the summer, because you'll have games, I guess, after the Euros to do that. So, it's going to be an interesting one, I think. And you mentioned the golden generation. And of course, we had that, didn't we, with potentially with Rooney, Beckham, Scholes, Gerrard, Lampard, etc. And that didn't come to fruition. And you've got to remember, of course, that, you've already mentioned, Gareth Southgate's successes. He's probably the most successful England manager since Sir Ralph Ramsey. So all that taken into consideration, I think England have got a fantastic opportunity and a fantastic chance of lifting the trophy in the summer. But it will be interesting to see whether or not he gives, his forward-thinking players, his more attacking-minded players, certainly midfield players and strikers, the opportunity to, to be a little bit more creative than if you like in their play.
Yeah, I think so. I understand that he's got issues in defence. I get that. Harry Maguire is no longer a regular for Manchester United, and one or two other injuries like Luke Shaw and things like that. But if anything, that would just make me even more determined to get my attacking players into the game. And, you know, if we can't defend, let's make sure that the defence hasn't got to do too much defending. I can see why he goes with a double pivot in midfield, but ultimately, there's no real point in going with a double pivot if you haven't got a second pivot alongside Declan Rice. I mean, Declan Rice is probably the best in that role in the Premier League. But Hobby Mainoo looks okay, and he looked really good in the game that he played against Belgium. Really, really good. But ultimately, we're talking about a guy who's played 20, 25 games for Manchester United. To take him to the Euros in that role might be considered risky. And his other options, based on what he had in this squad, are Jordan Henderson, who, as I said, I just think his days have been and gone at this level. And Conor Gallagher, who didn't impress me at all against Brazil. I thought he was either completely out of confidence or just doesn't like the role that he was playing. But he did not look comfortable at all. What I wanted to find out in this international break was who will be Harry Kane's next in line, so to speak, because if anything does happen to Harry Kane, England are in trouble. I think we did find that out. I think Ivan Toney looked really, really good against Belgium. And I like the way that Toney comes deep. You've got lots of pace in that England forward line. So I would probably have Toney over an Ollie Watkins. Ollie Watkins is kind of a running behind sort of striker. But I can't think of a game in the Euros, Craig, certainly in the early stages of the Euros, where a defence is going to be high up against England. You're playing against Denmark, who generally defend quite deep, and a couple of minnows who are obviously also going to defend deep and try and hit England on counter-attack. So I'm kind of glad that he saw Toney, because I did think that actually Dominic Solanke would be the man for that role, but Ivan Toney did look good. So that was a positive from the two games. But apart from that, I really don't think what he's taken from the games that he may not already have known. And he's just picked up another couple of injuries. But I think that England need a lot of players to return to fitness very quickly and be fit for the Euros if they're going to justify the bookmakers having them favourites for the tournament.
I remember us talking about Ollie Watkins a few weeks ago, didn't we? And saying, you know, what a great season he's had. And he was a little bit subdued, I thought, against Brazil. You know, I did watch some of the Brazil game, and he seemed a little bit subdued and not his usual sort of creative or dangerous self, if I'm honest. Ivan Toney's been great since he came back, you know, from his ban. And, you know, he's scoring goals again for Brentford, obviously. And of course, you know, there are still, you know, months to go before the start of the Euro Championship. So there is still time for players to reach, you know, form, and also to recover from injury. So I don't think it's all doom and gloom, Kevin, you know, as a Welshman commenting on the England team. I think, you know, England fans should approach it with optimism. Because there's more than enough quality in that squad to really make a huge impact at the tournament, for sure.
Makes me feel a little bit better. And like you say, we've still got another sort of 10 weeks until the tournament starts. Scotland are going to be at the Euros, though, Craig, and they're another team that didn't exactly have an enjoyable international break. Got a 4-0 thumping in the Netherlands over the weekend, although actually the bits of that game I saw, Scotland played really, really well in that game, but the Netherlands were just absolutely lights out when it came to being ruthless, which, you know, obviously the Dutch can be. But the bits that I saw against Northern Ireland on Tuesday night, and I have to stress these are only snippets from the game, I was much more focused on the Wales and England games with regards to that. But the bits that I saw against Northern Ireland would have concerned me. There was no sort of intensity, but I suppose that's understandable in a friendly, albeit one against Northern Ireland, a fellow home nation. You'd have thought the intensity would have come sort of naturally from that. And there was no sort of creativity in attacking areas. Now, Andy Robertson left the game pretty early, and he's quite a key sort of fixture in the Scotland attacking unit down at left back. So that was a big blow. But I do worry for Scotland where the goals are going to come from. I mean, Scott McTominay and John McGinn seem to be their leading sort of source of goals, and they're both midfielders, really. So that's a concern. And then eventually Conor Bradley, Liverpool fullback, popped up with a cracking goal, actually took a deflection, but ended up in the top corner. And from there on, Northern Ireland saw it out pretty easily from the bits that I saw. I'd be a little bit worried if I was Scotland. That really good form from the time where they beat Spain in qualifying and things, it's just started to nosedive a little bit. And I think they really needed a result on Tuesday night and they didn't get it.
Yeah, I read it. I read an article. I didn't see the game, but I read an article of a Steve Clarke interview after the Holland game, where they lost 4-0 in the Netherlands, and he said, you know, that really hit me hard. And in fact, it was the players who sort of got back on the horse quite quickly. But for him, it was a period of reflection and you know, just trying to work out what went wrong and why. And then, of course, then the 1-0 loss again to Northern Ireland would really have dented their confidence leading into the tournament for sure. And there's no doubt some work to be done in the Scotland camp prior to the Euros.
Yeah, unlike England, they don't have too many to come back into their ranks. And Germany first up in the first game of the European Championship, and they're suddenly starting to turn the corner, Germany. No surprise with Toni Kroos back in the centre of their midfield that they've turned their form around. That's already looking a daunting task. But we'll look ahead to the Euros once we've got the domestic season out of the way, and that becomes our focus of the summer. But Craig, domestic football is back this weekend, and I have to say I am so looking forward to it being back. And it comes back in the Premier League, at least, with another one of these title deciders. We've got the leaders Arsenal going to Manchester City on Sunday afternoon at the Etihad Stadium. A few hours before then, Liverpool play host to Brighton. So Liverpool could very well be top of the table by the time that game kicks off. But the Manchester City-Arsenal game, I get the impression that we're at the stage where if there's a winner of that game, given that the fixtures look pretty kind for the rest of them, if there's a winner of that game, it may put pay to the title chances, not completely of the loser, but the loser is really going to need some help from other teams to get back on track. So very much all to play for at the Etihad.
Yeah, it's the proverbial six-pointer, Kevin, isn't it? If you remember, we talked about the Liverpool-Arsenal game a few weeks ago, and we said, you know, both want to go out and win that game, obviously, to give themselves some distance between the other. But by the same token, you know, both teams don't want to lose it either. And of course, that game ended in a draw at Anfield. But yeah, Man City Arsenal, it's a mouth-watering fixture, isn't it? And you know, especially at this stage of the season where it's so tight at the top and everything to play for.
And of course, Mikel Arteta goes back to the Etihad, which I always think adds a little bit of spice to it. He was Pep Guardiola's assistant back in the day, and pretty much he's based his kind of success or the way that he's carried Arsenal through the years. He's based it on how Pep Guardiola's done it, hasn't he? He now uses inverted full-backs, which was a thing that Guardiola used. He's now bringing the centre-backs into midfield, isn't he? And Arsenal are starting to do that more and more with Ben White. And of course, he's taken some players from Manchester City, Zinchenko and Gabriel Jesus, which will also add fuel to the Arsenal fire, I would suspect. I like Arsenal. I must admit, I do like Arsenal. I like the way that they're going in the right direction. I still think they're the third best of these three. But I don't think the gap between them is anywhere near as big as maybe I thought it was a few weeks ago. But if they can get a result at the Etihad, that all changes.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely so. And again, we did say that we thought that, you know, the championship race that was going to go to the wire. And it certainly seems that way. But of course, this weekend could have a massive bearing on that, obviously. But you know, Mikel Arteta going back to Manchester City, where he was assistant, obviously, to Pep Guardiola, and obviously would have worked on a daily basis with him. And of course, they're both ex-Barcelona men as well, of course. So interesting, you know, to hear you say that Arsenal have got similar philosophies and playing principles as Manchester City, as you'd expect, really, given Arteta's background and playing background, but also his coaching background as well. At Manchester City, so yeah, it's going to be intriguing, and you know, I for one will be looking at the tactical aspects of that. You mentioned inverted fullbacks, which is a phrase everybody tends to use, but I don't particularly like it, because when we talk about inverted wingers, that means the left winger goes and plays on the right wing, and the right winger goes and plays on the left wing. So that's inverted winger. So that's inverted means an opposite change of roles, right? So therefore, if you're talking about inverted fullbacks, then your right back should then be playing left back, and your left back should be playing right back. But just a personal foible of mine. But so inside fullback, they play inside fullbacks as opposed to inverted fullbacks in my language. Which Guardiola says what it does is it gives them defensive solidity when they attack, because then they've got more cover in the central areas of the pitch. Because obviously the quickest route to goal is from, you know, goal to goal through the centre of the pitch. So if you can protect that, then oppositions then have to play around the outside of you and play in wider channels, which obviously is the wider route to goal. So you can see the rationale behind that. Plus also, of course, you know, Guardiola likes to attack these half spaces. So you've got the wide channels, and then inside that, then you've got the half spaces, which is huge. And if you look at Man City's attacking philosophies and tactics, they really do like to attack those inside areas, just inside the box, if you like. And an interesting stat, I think it was either from last year or the year before, that I think something like 70% or more of Manchester City's goals, the assists come from back passes back towards their own goal, because obviously they get into those areas and they put a cut back crossing. So that's another interesting tactic which Guardiola has been successful in implementing. And you know, when you've got people like De Bruyne, and obviously you've got Haaland then, who can arrive on those cutbacks, midfield players arriving as well. And of course, then you've got the one which is hung up the far post for Haaland to finish with his head as well. Then it's no wonder that Manchester City being so successful. But with Arsenal deploying similar tactics, you know, I'm intrigued. The tactical battle for me is going to be fascinating. And can't wait for the game.
Yeah, absolutely. It really does promise to be a great game. I mean, that Liverpool-Man City game that you referenced earlier turned into an absolute brilliant game. And of course, this one's all shaped up to be, particularly if Liverpool have already gone and got their 3 points against Brighton and have taken the lead in the Premier League. Yeah, so many battles. I hope Kyle Walker and John Stones are fit for that game, actually. They both left England internationals early. It would be a shame if such a heavyweight clash doesn't have its full contingent on both sides. So, fingers crossed that's the case and we'll get a good game of football. We'll also get some good games of football, Craig, in the EFL. There always used to be a saying, didn't there, when football was played at normal times and every game was Saturday at 3 o'clock, that Easter would always sort out the league table. Seems to be getting earlier and earlier this Easter period, but I think it's still very much the case, certainly in the Championship, where there's a huge match on Friday. We've got this four-team sort of battle, haven't we? Leeds, Leicester, Ipswich, Southampton. Sorry, the huge game comes on Monday, not Friday. Ipswich play Southampton, so they're third against fourth, and obviously Leicester are kind of slipping up a little bit. They're in a rough patch, both on and off the pitch. Actually, all of a sudden, Ipswich and Southampton have got themselves a chance to sort of do something there. I mean, before then, Southampton hosts Middlesbrough on Good Friday. Ipswich have a tricky little test away to Blackburn, who aren't exactly doing great themselves, and Leicester go to Bristol City on Good Friday. Really, really good Good Friday schedule. But that Ipswich-Southampton game, that might turn four into three once and for all in this race for automatic promotion.
Yeah, I think it might. If you look at Southampton, they're in fourth, aren't they, on 73 points after 36 games. So they got two games in hand on Ipswich, who are in third. Ipswich on 81 points. So an 8-point difference. But of course, Southampton have got two games in hand. So what we say, you know, points in the bag, better than games in hand. But if they were to win those two games in hand, then potentially that narrows that gap to 2 points. And then, of course, then that makes the game against Ipswich, Southampton, Ipswich game, a huge one. It's huge anyway, but particularly when you consider that Southampton got two games in hand on Ipswich. But as you say, if Ipswich were to win that one, you know, that then really does almost make it a three-horse race potentially. But in this division, you know, you never can tell, because teams are taking points off each other, you know, every week. Unexpected points as well, you know, from top to bottom. And I think there's no greater example of that than Leicester, really. Leicester at one stage. I think we mentioned we're 11 points clear, I think. And we thought it was almost, you know, cut and dried as far as it can be in football. But now, of course, they're level on points with Leeds. Leeds are top on a plus one goal difference. But of course, Leicester have still got that game in hand. So, yeah, it's an intriguing top of the division situation at the Championship. And yeah, I think it's a four horse race at the moment. But who knows? After the Easter fixtures, maybe it will turn into a three horse race.
Yeah, that game at Portman Road, 5:30 on Easter Monday. That is a big one. Two big games at the other end of the table as well over Easter Craig. On Good Friday, you have QPR against Birmingham. They're the two sides immediately above the relegation zone right now. They meet at Loftus Road. One of those is going to leave Good Friday, well, anything but Good Friday, aren't they? They're going to be in all sorts of trouble. And then on Easter Monday, one of the live games in the UK on Easter Monday is Stoke against Huddersfield. Huddersfield, the team currently in the bottom three, but they're only 2 points behind Stoke, who were 19th, and that one has all sorts of ramifications on it. Huddersfield have played Coventry on Good Friday. Stoke have gone to Hull, so the chances are neither are picking up any points before they do battle on Easter Monday. That feels like a massive game of football for two clubs who would probably think that they should be at the other end of the table based on recent sort of seasons, who could find themselves in all sorts of trouble should they lose on Monday.
Absolutely. And you know, we spoke a couple of weeks ago about the, you know, if we thought the top of the table was tight, then, you know, you look at the Championship bottom end and Millwall in 16th, or even Swansea in 15th. You got Huddersfield in occupying the final relegation spot in 22nd place with 39 points. Millwall in 16th, only 4 points ahead, you know. So it's really, really tight down there. And that QPR Birmingham City game is going to be huge, as you say. And yeah, both teams, you know, who've always, you know, usually contested the top of the Championship, now find themselves in a relegation battle. Birmingham, if you remember, changed their manager early in the season when they were in the playoff positions, brought Wayne Rooney in. That didn't go particularly well, and now find themselves in a, you know, in a relegation dogfight. Queen's Park Rangers, a club which I've always enjoyed watching and visiting and played there once many years ago in a reserve team fixture. Yeah, you know, to see them down there as well, you know, is a surprise. But as you said, the Championship is so tight this season, you know, and teams are taking points off one another top to bottom, really.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, really, really compelling couple of fixtures on Good Friday and Easter Monday in the Championship. And it's the same in League One as well, Craig. The headline game on Friday is actually at the bottom end. Second from bottom, Fleetwood, play third from bottom, Cheltenham. We mentioned back in one of the earlier podcasts how it took Cheltenham an absolute age to score a goal this season, never mind get any points. But all of a sudden, they're within 4 points of safety with a game in hand of Cambridge United. Fleetwood have played two games more than Cheltenham, so they really, really have to win that game on Good Friday. Otherwise, you kind of sense that the division's getting away from them. And then on, well, not Easter Monday, it's meant to be Easter Monday, but it's moved to the Tuesday night for TV coverage. The top two meet, Portsmouth and Derby. Portsmouth currently 5 points ahead of Derby with a game in hand. Obviously, top two is what both are aiming for there, but that one could determine who wins League One this season. Certainly, if Portsmouth were to beat Derby, and in recent form, maybe that might happen. It could be the night that Portsmouth certainly solidify their automatic promotion claims, but possibly go a long way to winning the title as well.
Yeah, Derby have won four of the last five, I think. Portsmouth are unbeaten in five, drawn two, won three of those. But yeah, you'd think potentially, but then again, we've just spoken about Leicester having a great lead and that being cut. But I just think Portsmouth probably will have too much for Derby. And if they can take the 3 points, that gives them an 8 point lead plus the game in hand, you know. So, yeah, potentially, you know, after these Easter fixtures, Portsmouth could be very much clear favourites and almost, you know, the title within their grasp, I would have thought.
Yeah, that's how I see it. That's a huge game. Tuesday evening for that one. That's on Sky Sports. For those of you that have Sky Sports in the UK. So, yeah, well worth tuning into that one. If we dip into League Two very quickly, Craig, there's not a huge amount of what you would call standout fixtures over the two sort of fixture lists. But one that does come along on Good Friday, and again, it's got television coverage. Third place Wrexham host the leaders Mansfield. There's only 3 points between the two of them at start of play. And again, whilst their focus will be on making sure that they finish in the top three, it's always nice to head towards the title. And a Mansfield win would put them 6 points ahead of Wrexham with six to play. So you would think that while Wrexham wouldn't be out of the equation, Mansfield's goal difference is currently 20 better, obviously benefited from that 9-2 win over Harrogate earlier in the season. Wrexham would probably then be looking at just getting automatic promotion, wouldn't they? Whereas a Wrexham win would go level on points with Mansfield, and all of a sudden we've got ourselves a right title race.
Yeah, another great game, isn't it? It's you know, it's it really is a Easter weekend is full of great football potential, and none more so than that game. You know, Mansfield, yeah, enjoying top spot at the moment, as you said, and that goal difference could be huge come the end of the season, couldn't it? You know, on to decide the title eventually. But I'm sure Stockport will have something to say about that as well. Obviously, they're in second, only 2 points behind Mansfield, a point above Wrexham. But of course, they've got a game in hand as well. So, you know, potentially they could go top. And they're a plus 35 goal difference, Mansfield on plus 42 and Wrexham on plus 22. So, yeah, the Wrexham-Mansfield game is huge, but, you know, don't take your eye off Stockport as well.
Yeah, I watched Stockport on Saturday evening. They were on television, and obviously no Championship or Premier League at the weekend. So I took that game in on TV when I got back from the Ladies' Cup final that I mentioned last week. And I'll come on to that in a moment. And Stockport won 5-0 against Milton Keynes Dons. They looked really, really good. So that's definitely a three-way title race at the moment. And if Wrexham do win that game, it very much remains a three-way title race. So, yeah, that's huge. I think at this point, Craig, we should actually say congratulations to Chesterfield. We mentioned in last week's podcast that they were going to get promoted from the National League. Well, they didn't on the night that they could have done against Halifax. But maybe it was better off that they didn't do it on that night, because they got promotion in front of their own fans on Saturday with a pretty comfortable 3-0 win over Boreham Wood, which was more than enough to earn the title and send them back into the Football League after far too long away from it.
Yeah, absolutely. I had the pleasure of taking the Lewis women's team there. We played against Sheffield United, actually, at the Chesterfield Stadium. And it's a fantastic stadium. And of course, Chesterfield, you know, very much, you know, very a long-term Football League team, so it'd be great to see them back in the Football League. Obviously, they reached the 100 goals mark as well, and it looks as if they're going to reach over 100 points as well in this campaign. So congratulations to them very much.
Yeah, brilliant stuff from Paul Cook, and well-deserved. Chesterfield have, well, they've dominated the National League, haven't they? And I'm really looking forward to getting towards the playoffs of that, and sure to be some great action, as we spoke about last week. I also spoke, Craig, about the Women's National League Cup final. It was taking place at Kenilworth Road. My nieces wanted to go. They wanted to watch some women's football. There was no Luton game on, so I was more than happy to take them. Hashtag United against Newcastle United. Newcastle would have gone there as huge favourites, and when they took the lead and went 1-0 up, I think most sort of thought they were on their way to victory. But hashtag, they had something about them. They dug in there. They were comfortably the second best in the game. I think that has to be said. The hashtag goalkeeper was excellent. But when their chances come along, hashtag, they took them. They were clinical. The winning goal was scored 12 minutes from time from a substitute. Lovely move, actually. Really well worked play down the right hand side. Got to the byline. Goalkeeper kind of came out for a ball that she probably shouldn't have done. The cutback went past her, and then there's a nice sort of, not a tapping into an empty net, but an empty net from sort of 10 yards out to score the winning goal for hashtag United. So it's hashtag United that won the cup. But the most important thing was the crowd there that day were just under 4,000. There was due to be more, but some real transport problems around the place at the weekend. Some issue on the train network and things, which put paid to some of the hashtag fans getting there, I believe. But just under 4,000 were there, and a good time was had by all. Unfortunately, the weather conditions were atrocious, but the game of football was really, really good. There were so many youngsters there, so many females there, and it was just a real good occasion. And yeah, fair play to both sides for putting up a real good show.
No, it just goes to show, doesn't it? You know, two neutral teams, teams playing at neutral venues, and you know, getting that sort of crowd given the transport problems. And I believe Newcastle United took a huge contingent, as you said, as well. So yeah, full credit to them. And of course, you know, Newcastle, even though they lost the league cup final, then you know, I'm sure they'll be a force to be reckoned with in women's football, you know, in the coming seasons.
Yeah, it looked really good. Just one of those days where the opposition goalkeeper had a moment in the spotlight. And yeah, I really, really enjoyed that. So well done to everyone who went. And my two nieces have been to see live women's football and they love it. And they'll go back next time they get the opportunity to do that. And that's really what that game was all about from our point of view. So yeah, kudos to everyone involved. Really, really good occasion. That's almost it for this episode of the podcast, but we did suggest a poll on the podcast last week, which was for the PFA Player of the Season to get your votes in. That poll is still open, so we haven't actually got the official results, but people are in line with us, Craig, because Phil Foden's currently leading the way, and I think he was generally one of our picks for that award, and it's no surprise, really, a standout player in a standout team.
Yeah, he's had a great season, hasn't he? And I'm sure you'll be up there, you know, when the professional footballers decide, you know, to vote on their own award, the PFA award. I'm sure he'll be up amongst the favourites then as well. And as I say, Martin Odegaard as well. He's one of mine, which I mentioned, who I think he's had a great influence at Arsenal this season. And it'd be interesting to see if he's there or thereabouts as well.
Yeah, Virgil van Dijk was my sort of dark horse contender, and yeah, he's continuing to have a great season. So yeah, still a couple of days to vote for that if you want to. And of course, a couple of months until we find out who wins it. As I said earlier in the podcast, there's a poll about Gareth Southgate. Do get your votes in. It'll be very interesting to see whether you're a Southgate fan, Southgate not fan, or not really sure on Southgate either way. But as Craig said earlier in the podcast, he probably is England's most successful manager since Sir Alf Ramsey and certainly since Sir Bobby Robson. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how everyone goes about that. That is it for this episode of the podcast. If you are going to any of the Easter football matches, do enjoy it. Be respectful as always. Hope your team wins, unless of course you're a Tottenham Hotspur fan, in which case I hope you lose, because I will be at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium on Saturday afternoon, Craig, as Luton look to keep their heads above water now that they've come out of the relegation zone. That's my weekend sorted. How about yourself?
Yes, I'll be coaching at the weekend, Kevin, and obviously trying to watch as much football as I can, both Premier League and the EFL. But yeah, just hope that you enjoy enjoy the game against Spurs, and just want to wish everybody a happy Easter. Enjoy your football.
Absolutely. So much great football on this weekend. Really do enjoy it. And we will be back next week to review it all and a little look ahead to a huge game in Scotland next weekend as Celtic and Rangers battle it out in a massive game. So that's all to come. But until then, thanks very much for listening, and we'll be with you next week. Bye-bye.